I don't really know why, nor do I know how to stop it. She punched me the first time I met her, and she punched me just a few minutes ago when she found out I was going to talk about how she punches me in this intro. She could just be gearing up until she stabs me instead of punches me. But really, I think that she's just too American. Perhaps the most American person I know, despite being born in India. In her rebellious youth, she led a strike against fascist nuns in her boarding school in India, fighting the better fight to get more biscuits. She's so mad already. And she was asked to leave by the administration or face expulsion. And now that's American. That's pretty American. To lead a strike in a boarding school. She came to the States afterwards, received her MFA from Bowling Green, spending her days looking upon the vast amber plains of subsidized corn and whispering the Star-Spangled Banner into the Lake Erie winds, wondering if there is ever a more majestic place on earth than Ohio. She found her answer when she came to Tallahassee. It was in this fecund vomit swamp of North Florida that she took her first trip to the most American place of all, Costco. And I witnessed her clutching a 7-pound block of cheese straight to her chest, like she was in a Terrence Malick film. Her sweet Parmesan come home to her. It was beautiful. In her tenure at FSU, Misha has published work in the Indiana Review, Hayden's Ferry Review, the Missouri Review blog, and the Sonora Review, where she was a finalist for the 2015 Essay Prize. Pretty impressive. She'll be reading nonfiction for us tonight, and she has been working on a novel, which apparently she can't bear to look at anymore. That's a direct quote from her. Although when it is published, it will surely be brilliant. Misha is the most tenacious, no-nonsense, Booker opinionated person I have ever met. And I assume she's sitting over there sharpening the knife that she is going to stab me with as I leave this stage. But it's gonna be an American knife. Because in all the facets of her life, her writing, her editing, her teaching, only the best is good enough for Misha. And only the best is American. So please help me welcome Misha Rai.
Thank you, Todd. I don't know what to say after that. I feel rather American. thanks, Ruth and Zach. So I'm going to read the first half of an essay I've sort of been working on. And it's really rough, so I apologize. It's called To Learn About Smoke, One Must First Light a Fire. In 1968, my uncle, 6 years old at the time, with what he believed to be his unique concoction of water and petrol, unevenly doused the sofa in the drawing room, wriggled under it, and when he had positioned himself exactly in the middle of the four-seater, struck a match. The odor of his mischief reached Dai, the woman who raised him and my mother and my aunt, and who would raise my brother and me and our cousins during winter vacations, a moment before it reached my grandmother. Dai had just finished putting away the bucket of water and wet mop she used to clean the floors, and was unhitching her sari so that her legs, exposed an inch above her knees all the way to her ankles, would again be appropriately covered. My grandmother was one lick away from closing the flap of an envelope, the last of two sets of lavender envelopes that contained weekly letters to her many siblings and cousins. The unlicked, thus also the unglued corner of the envelope would later haunt my grandmother, who was convinced that all postmen steamed open the post, given any kind of provocation. This is India, she would say, a phrase she repeats even now as explanation whenever challenged about her absolute belief in the miscreancy of the Indian government and its representatives. Like many children of the 1940s, born into the upper class and caste, my grandmother, proud to be part of independent India, missed the imagined efficiency of the colonizer. It was true that the British had industrialized India, but it was also true that no matter how hard they tried, they could never get the trains to arrive at their assigned stations on time, or begin a meeting at an appointed hour, because Indians submitted to their own notion of time, Indian standard, where a couple of minutes never means two, but in actuality stretches to 15 or even 18 minutes. And like those of her generation and others that came after, roiling deep within my grandmother's consciousness was the belief that the British as a species were somehow better, that they had raised the Indian character by their superior presence. And so absolute was this belief that my grandmother, like many others, often forgot what India and Indians were truly like. Reams of records and personal accounts in the British Library detailed the frustration with which the British had tried to transform the country. Unlike other rulers before them who had understood that the only way to govern such a land and its people was to become a part of it, the English fueled the fires that ripped the country into two when they were finally kicked out, leaving it in chaos, close to the way they believed they had found it. India was the fierce kink in the forehead of my grandmother's hair, repeatedly oiled, bobby pinned, pinioned into an unlikely plait, even shorn close to her head, always unwilling to stay under the sari pallu that covered her hair. The place custom dictated for it to remain, a real hairdressing headache, yet also a physical characteristic that added to my grandmother's beauty and grace, whether she accepted it or not. Regardless of the opinion held by my grandmother, the Indian Postal Service and its postmen had a reputation even in the 1960s. Letters were known to disappear and reappear years later. Envelopes arrived with their contents missing. Passports were held ransom until the tip for delivering them safely had passed from one palm to another. Even now, it is not uncommon to receive letters that have been clearly ripped open by inserting an index finger. A faint telltale betel nut stain is sometimes visible, coloring the jagged route the offending letter opener has taken. Parcels often arrive with half their contents missing. Like many others of her class and generation who had sallied forth to Britain and had come back homesick, my grandmother was nostalgic for the neatly dressed British postal worker who brought the mail to her letterbox every day at the same time, who said hello, love, and nothing else before departing her Sunderland home, a place close to her heart because my uncle was born there. Hurrying to find the cause of the smell she couldn't properly identify, smoke so out of place in her home, my grandmother had pressed the base of her fingers on the flap, sealed that last letter, and tossed it on the pile made up of others of its kind. Because my uncle could not reach high enough to lock the doors of the drawing room, three in total, although the one door leading outdoors was already latched on the inside, both the women felt they had fallen sideways into a sailing smoke the moment they pushed the doors open. Dai was already hitting one part of the sofa with towels she had wet under the kitchen sink. She, acquainted lifelong with smoke that arose from burning wood and combustible cloth, necessary fuel that helped cook her meals on the dung-cleansed clay stove in her mud hut, had known exactly what to do. She had opened the windows as well. My grandmother and Dai were halfway through putting out the fire when they heard the click-click from under the sofa. My uncle Dai dragged out ankles first. He had been clicking his shoe buckle against shoe buckle, a sound he manufactured when he was excited. His nose and mouth were wrapped in his older sister's muffler, her school color of red too much of a reminder of the disaster unfolding in that room. My grandmother, when she could look at her son clearly, slapped him once. Family law, corroborated many times by my grandmother's undulating voice, has it that having realized as a young mother that her cream-colored hands were too soft, not exactly weak, but just not built for the kind of disciplining her three children sometimes needed, she had had to come up with other ways to punish her children when they misbehaved. On one occasion, she had taken a bowl of cornflakes and poured it over an offending head. Us children believed that she used to sit at her desk in the afternoons thinking of new ways to torture us, while Lata Mangeshkar sang songs of love in the background, my uncle likes to say. Radio and torture went hand in hand, no? Isn't that true, Moti Mummy? He will pinch his mother's waist, holding the roll of fat in his hand for a moment before she swats him away. It took Dai and me all morning to get the cornflakes out of his hair, and he still reeked of milk for days. The story goes that my grandmother, after she peeled my uncle off of Dai's one exposed leg, knee, calf, ankle, made him sit on the half-burned sofa to wait the judgment of his father without so much as wiping the gray off his face or letting Dai change his clothes. No food was to pass his lips until he had learned his lesson. My grandfather was downstairs in the surgery operating on a woman with cataract. Around the time my uncle lit his match, his father administered a slap across the patient's face. Earlier that day, as the only doctor and surgeon in the coal mining area of Dhanbad, my grandfather had been called out to the village of Vasepur. In 2012, the bloody history of Vasepur, beginning in the 1940s, when the British Raj seized farmlands in Dhanbad for their coal, to the 1990s, when two rival mafia families fought almost to extinction, would be immortalized into a four-hour movie, long even by Bollywood standards. But on the day my grandfather drove over, following closely behind his police escort, wounds needed patching up. The people of Vasepur claim that the movie wrongly portrays their village, and that apart from petty crime, peace reigns there. Some of the teenage boys my grandfather worked on, setting their bones, suturing knife wounds, digging out bullets, went on to join the local coal mafia and were dead within 10 years, by the time my uncle was 16. My grandfather came back with his right shirt sleeve ringed in inches of blood. Since he had missed the consultation time reserved in the mornings with his patients, he went straight to the surgery. Every afternoon, he devoted a portion of his time to operate on coal miners with various eyes, nose, throat issues. But before them came the patients who paid for not only their own surgeries, but the surgeries he performed after, for free. And among these paying patients was the woman he slapped. She had insisted that her husband be allowed to stay with her in the operating room. Her request had been refused. After much persuasion from the head nurse, she agreed to go ahead with the operation. A local anesthetic was applied, so while her face grew numb, she was still awake, but could not stop fidgeting or crying, and my grandfather's hand shook each time he tried to cut into her eye. Afterwards, my grandfather would tell the patient's shocked husband, "This is India." The operation was a success. He would use the same words to describe the altercation that happened in the surgery to his wife, and she would need no other explanation. He was aware that spouses and parents were now being allowed into some operating theaters in other parts of the world, even in the Royal Alexandra Hospital in Sunderland, where he had worked before returning to India. But he did not believe that the mores of his operating theater could adapt to such delicacies. For decades now, he had worked with coal miners, men who helped fuel the nation who needed him the most, who asked little of him and did what he requested. He was tired of Indians who came back to the country for medical procedures that cost them less in India, yet wanted the hospital culture to emulate those of the Western countries they lived in. Years later, when my aunt made an offhand remark about how all the patients who received such treatment, because there were others her father slapped, were always somehow women, my mother would quietly say, "Don't you know? These are Indian women and this is India," only to have her ear chewed out by my grandmother. My uncle, who had especially dressed himself up in the shorts and shirt he had worn a few weeks ago to sit for a portrait his parents had commissioned of him, was trying hard not to swing his legs against the damaged sofa as he thought of ways to make up his explanation, his story of why he conducted the experiment or burned the sofa more elaborate. He had failed to impress his mother with his original excuse and had somehow got it into his head that a grand beginning of his tale would do the trick. At any rate, he was convinced his father would appreciate the fact that he had worn his best clothes to carry out such an important task. Nothing he said that day would have helped him, but if he had stuck to the truth, perhaps it could have helped diminish the manner in which his punishment was administered. Dai got rid of my uncle's clothes after my grandmother decided they were not fit to be worn again, but they shine through the portrait that still hangs in our ancestral home in Dhanbad. My uncle is painted on canvas as a serious little boy standing next to a large chair, dressed in a starched white shirt, blue shorts, and a red tie to complete his outfit. In his hand is a pistol. His finger is not quite on the trigger and he holds it lopsided, but his chest is puffed out with pride. These last two details would characterize my uncle for the rest of his life. As a family, we do not know if the student artist saw something of my uncle's future as he painted the chattering little boy he spent a week with, or if we have in hindsight insinuated what we know of my uncle onto the portrait. My uncle would qualify to enter the army as an officer when he turned 18, but his parents would not permit him to join. He would then gain admission to study at London School of Economics, but would not be allowed to take up his place. He would fall in love with a Norwegian journalist, but give her up when he kept putting off introducing her to his parents, and eventually his courage failed him. He would go to film school, but never make any movies. He would qualify to work for the Indian Broadcasting Corporation, but quit just as he reached a position that allowed him to make important broadcasting decisions. He would run a restaurant to the ground. And all the while, he would talk and talk and talk about the things he could have, would have, should have done, and some things that he had done. But everything seemed exaggerated and muddled in his telling, until people stopped believing him. And that realization sunk in. As that realization sunk in, he felt compelled to continue talking, but his stories changed, became more outrageous, until only half-truths and lies remained. But on that day, he was still a little boy, his mind racing to come up with an impressive excuse that would save him. My grandmother sat across from him, pasting stamps onto lavender envelopes, barely paying attention to what she was doing. Fear at almost losing her only son finally stilled her. To my grandfather, my uncle would begin by saying, "I wanted to see how fire was made." He was thrashed, a word and deed the English nuns gave as a gift to my grandmother, who had studied at a convent school, and she passed it along as appropriate punishment to be meted out thoroughly by my grandfather. Apart from the human bodies my grandfather patched up in Vasipur that morning, he had also written a death certificate for the charred corpses of a family that had been accidentally caught in the crossfire. Their house had been set aflame instead of that of rival gang members. The dead children, four of them, born in quick succession one after the other, were not much older than my uncle. Usually, before my uncle was disciplined, he was allowed a little bit of time to prepare himself for the beating, and his father spoke to him between each lash. Not words of comfort exactly, but he felt comforted nonetheless. This time, my uncle was hauled up and upended on the coffee table. My grandmother, unable to move, watched the first lash fall, and apart from the sound itself, there was silence. Each time my grandfather's hand fell to his side, my uncle saw the belt with which he was being disciplined and the ring of blood on his father's shirt sleeve. Thank you.
Thank you, Misha. Okay, that was great, right? Can we get another round of applause for her? I think we should also get a round of applause for this new mic stand. You know, last semester was like dropping, it was like when an ice cream cone is melting, you're like, come back to me, please. Okay, all right, so we're going to take, is it 15 minutes? 10 minutes. 10 minutes to get your drinks and use the bathroom. Okay, so what's he saying?
It's still my favorite thing. All right. William Todd Seabrook is a PhD candidate at FSU and the co-editor of the cupboard pamphlet. I've started really badly, sorry. He's the author of 4 chapbooks, of which Lewis Carroll chapbook has sold out forever because he is that big a deal. He made me say that. His fiction and nonfiction can be found in Phoebe, The Volta, Tin House, Mid-American Review, Pank, Cut Bank, Quiddity, among elsewhere. Okay, now that I've gotten that bit of like self-promotion out of the way, Todd's talent-related advertising out of the way, I'm going to start the real introduction. So, ready? Okay, this is the second time I've had the privilege of introducing Todd, so I'm being very careful about what I say. Because last time the magnificent David Kirby was in the audience and he spent weeks not letting me live down what I said. Essentially, I had talked about how I first met Todd's work and then Todd, thus the friendship. This is when I worked for Mid-American Review and we got a wonderful story of his and we fell in love with it. I also pointed out that our relationship was based on a certain amount of physical violence that Todd has already referenced. Anyways, the introduction ends, Todd's reading is brilliant, I'm on the 4th floor of Williams the next day and David Kirby walks past me, only to suddenly and rather violently fall against the wall and call out in my general direction, "Don't hit me." This happens a few more times, okay? until he decides to rope in my friend Gabby. And like Gabby's just standing there, and he tells Gabby, you saw her, she hit me. And Gabby, she's such a wonderful person, she's like, yeah. I mean, like friends like that, right? Okay. I've learned my lesson. I don't want people going around the department saying she's violent, so I'm going to try a new tack here. This is what I have to say about Todd. Even though he and I live in the same city and have offices on the same floor, we do not see each other very often. We don't hang out a lot or communicate frequently through the interwebs. But when I hunt him down, I know I have always made the right choice, because apart from the violence, there is a lot of laughter and ridiculous conversation that I cherish. We often talk about how slowly we write. If there was a competition that gave prizes out to writers who write a line a day or less, or even less sometimes, Todd and I would probably be tied in first place. And though I believe that Todd must read more lady writers, every time I have needed help as a lady writer and sort of a lady, and reached out to him, the man has said when and where. None of the I need to check my calendar bullshit. He's turned up and let me boss him around and frankly monopolize more time than he had to give. And here's the kicker. This is his last year at FSU. But I'm going to miss him terribly. Partly because he has taken a vow of poverty. His magnificent yet weird-ass writing and postmodernist taste lead down that road. And I have no interest in that. Partly because to me he represents something that is the very essence of the writers here at FSU. Complete dedication to his craft. I'm so glad that I'm going to be graduating after him, because I can follow in his footsteps. Also, and I say this with gritted teeth, and he's making me serious, he's from Cleveland, Ohio. Now, he's going to read his weird take on a marriage he may or may not have gone to. Well, it's fiction, so put your hands together for William Todd Seabrook.
I'm back. Oh my God, what a mic stand. It stays in place.
All right. I am going to read that story. I'm going to read three other things before that. Three shorts.
Can you hear me?
Can you hear me? These three things from a larger collection of pieces that take place in the future. They're basically the media industry in the future about how we solve the problem of living in the universe without dying. So it won't make sense. I don't know why I said that, but nevertheless, the project. Okay, so these are solutions. The solution, the quantum light bulb. The idea of the quantum light bulb was first described in 1933 by Nicolaus Lowell in his doctoral thesis titled Leaving the Gods, which lays down the mathematical framework for the quantum entanglement. The merit of Lowell's paper is still contentious. Many claim his work is too ridiculous to be brilliant, or too brilliant to be ridiculous. To this day, no scientific journal has ever published Lowell's original paper, despite the extensive writing dedicated to explaining it. Even his doctoral committee at Caltech was forced to reject his dissertation, saying that Lowell's work is not merit to academic standards.
Or any standards, for that matter.
Did you read the thing? This committee's chemistry standards when the first quantum bulb was put into production. It's complete and utter nonsense. And if you didn't vanish from the face of the earth, it would have won the Nobel Prize. Lowell's entire thesis was 22 pages long. Each page is filled with hand-written equations devoid of any explanation or theoretical framework. The only words in the entire paper are the two sentences that serve as an introduction. They read, It is unwise for a thief to draw attention to himself. Surely there will be hell to pay. What follows is a mathematical labyrinth riddled with structural holes and logical dead ends. Hollow, part of dozen different topologies of the universe, spliced in his own math, and sewed them all together in such bizarre geometry that is barely recognizable as a formulation of the universe. The levels of intricacy and convolution of Hollow's math are both astounding and completely unnecessary. MIT physicist Lakshmi Rai separated out a mathematical chief from their doctoral thesis titled Thieving Halalali, and although it took over 400 pages, she found that Halalali's work would be reduced to a single elegant formula. Now known as the Halalali-Rai equation, the formula shows how photons can be pulled out of thin air, with the energy cost falling on its entangled particle of antimatter, a process that is instantaneous and repeatable to a nearly infinite degree. It is only a matter of months after Rai published her work on Halalali that the first quantum light bulbs were designed. They are simple devices, a quantum well attached to a refracting arc, easy enough to be made at any science fair or college classroom. They require no power source. They have no wattage limits, and work the same at the bottom of the ocean as they do in low Earth orbit. They are an inexhaustible source of pure light, a way to slip under the skin of the universe and pull out ordered materials. It is easy to forget that the world was not always so well illuminated, that we were not always thieves. It is important to remember that the universe grows darker with every particle of light we take. And one day the universe will turn its gaze to the bright incandescence of humanity, glowing with its own light. It is the reason there are fine block letters written at the base of every quantum light bulb. They're there so we don't forget where the light came from. So that we don't forget what Halalali knew all along. They read, "Beware, this light is stolen straight from the black heart of the universe."
That's what they're like. Alright, next one. I might just do two of these. The Rendon step, the tenth solution. The tenth solution was discovered by Spanish tightrope walker Marco Rendon. Rendon believed that there were invisible strings connecting every part of the universe, and that it was possible to walk across them if only we had the balance. The problem, he said, was that life was too frantic in trying to stay alive. to walk such delicate lines. Each breath shifts our weight, our bodies tremble with every heartbeat, our muscles brace for the impact of the world, and also worry they will not be there when our step lands. In his last performance for the Circo de Epico, an acrobatics troupe based in Barcelona, Rendon stopped in the middle of his routine and tossed away his balancing bar. Then he kicked off his shoes and pulled his shirt over his head. The crowd stopped clapping when he stood on one foot and pulled off one pant leg, then the other, until he stood naked on his wire, arms at his sides and a calm look in his eyes. When the crew tried to raise the nets, they found that the mesh had been slashed and the mechanisms disabled. They scrambled to replace the pulleys and sew up the holes, but they knew that there wasn't time for it. The crowd felt the panic in the crew's movements. Some left, unable to face the impending disaster. Others moved closer, unwilling to turn away from it. Rendon stood motionless for all of it. There was no tremble in the wire, no flinch in his arms. Even the rhythm of his chest had slowed down until it seemed as if his breathing ceased altogether. It was only then that Rendon stretched out his leg, his torso shifting back. He did it slowly, toggling his fingers in minute increments for counterbalance. He bent his knee, moving his weight forward, and with a gasp from the audience, he stepped off the wire. Even though he died upon impact, his spine snapped in six places. There was a brief moment in the air when the void resisted his weight, holding him up for a fraction of a second before collapsing. When they examined his body, they found a faint line scratched down the length of his sole. Of his foot. It's sole of his foot. And he couldn't help but wonder if the universe was nothing more than a giant counterweight to the sorrow of humanity. All right. No, you don't have to clap. You don't. Clap. Yeah, that's right. Clap. All right, I'm going to skip the last one. Okay, I'm just going to go to the story. This is a story, as Misha introduced, that is partially nonfiction, partially fiction. I'll let you figure out which one's which. This is called Joel Had a Wedding and We All Went. Joel had a wedding and we all went. The groomsmen played bocce on the grass, all of us throwing the balls, red, yellow, blue, green, all the colors and all the balls, throwing them into the mud, the gravel, the tar, into the nests made of needles and the chip cherry mulch. We kept losing the balls, of course, one under the bride's mother's dress, one on the dance floor, one baked into the cake. We threw them into the boats on the lake and at the cars in the lot, into the sand in the sandbox, at the kids in the sandbox, too. We drank from Garrett's flask. The Holocaust was better than that throw. And because we couldn't change a thing, we played it as it lie. One turn took hours, the Polino rolling down over the pass all the way down the Eisenhower. If God saw that throw, Brad, he'd have nothing to say to you. Lost another ball at the bottom of a well, another to the weather, lost all the colors, scuffed off the bocces until we couldn't tell them apart, eventually lost all the balls too, all the colors and all the balls, and we played, waiting for the bride to arrive. She wouldn't go for a guy like you. Joel had a wedding and we all went. At the rehearsal dinner, we ate brisket and ribs and drank Easy Streets. We saluted with our steak knives in every picture. When we finished a plate, we called for another. Garçon, famished, I tell you. And when they didn't come fast enough, we traveled to other tables and snatched up their scraps, asking the father of the bride if she liked men who could eat. Joel's sister placed a piece of hanger steak on her tongue. Come and get it. Well, Joel's grandfather showed us how to tie slip knots with the strings of brisket. His wife told him not to drink so much. We drank more beer. I'm not done. Are you done? Drank more beer. Ate the meat knots. Drank more beer. Drank more beer. The knots only grew tighter in our stomachs. Joel had a wedding and we all went. We rolled the tables out of the closet and strung up the lights, hanging them from every nail, then deciding on every other, changed it back again, she won't notice, and went to get the alcohol and ice. A keg of sunshine, a keg of Budweiser, 15 bags of ice, and a sixer of Twisted Pine to get us through the morning. We could drink at 10:30 because it's mountain time. On the way back, we stopped at a Home Depot to get rubber trash cans for the kegs, and Andy spent a half hour in the floral department picking out a single white rose to match her dress. Garrett and Brad cracked beers in the aisles. On the way back to the condo, we stashed the ice and the kegs at the reception hall, and we almost rolled through them onto the cake, which would have been a disaster. It would have been just a goddamn nightmare. Joel had a wedding and we all went. We toasted and the speeches were all made at once so no one would be left out, so no one would be heard. The bridesmaids spoke in a chorus, the words pooling in their high heels and making the dance floor slick. Joel's grandfather yelled about proper boxing form, his fists wrapped in his tie, punching at the in-laws, to keeping your shoulders square. Joel's brother rambled on for so long that his voice disappeared, to silence and shame. And he kept going, pointing at Joel, pointing at everyone, smiling and mouthing, this is long, I know, I lost my notes, but please listen. Joel had a wedding and we all got lit. We killed the kegs and got two more, found another in the couch cushions, another in the cake, rolled out the wine barrels and broke them open with our heels, guzzled the purple liquid out of our wingtips, ripped out the splinters from our lips, and all the while sloshing about in gurgling toast, to us who never had a chance, it hardly matters now. Wringing the last drops from the hems of the bridesmaids' dresses, we stacked the champagne waterfall so high we had to cut a hole in the ceiling. Joel's grandfather got licked and told us the stories of boxing in the Navy, slamming Garrett with a haymaker and knocking him out for an hour. We held his nose and poured shots down his throat so he wouldn't fall behind. Glasses clinked and knives clinked and we all clinked and soon everything was shattered, the waterfall tumbling down in a harrowing screech, the dance floor a lawn of glass. We danced and danced and danced and danced until our heels ground all into sand, sand so fine it molecules dissolved into the air. Joel had a wedding and we all went. His sister danced with all of us. She had a swimmer's body and spun like a torpedo, the yellow bridesmaid dress flinging itself to the corners of the room. Her hair clung to her face and she breathed deeply like she was about to go under and never come back up. We let her sit on our laps and lean into us on the dance floor. She told us she had a boyfriend back in South Dakota, a bow hunter, but he didn't have to know anything. I can't believe my baby brother is married. She kissed us on the cheek, kissed us on our cheeks because we turned our heads. Joel had a wedding and we all went. They cut the cake and we smashed the pieces into our faces. Brad knocking out two teeth on a bocce ball. Garrett choking on all the colors. We watched the bride dance and spin, and Joel was there too. And we got on the dance floor and jitterbugged up next to her, and she laughed but didn't laugh. And we had to laugh and laugh and laugh. We had to. Joel's grandfather put holes in the dance floor, spilling beer everywhere, slicking up our shoes until we were sliding into one another, grasping, clutching, "I don't need your help," ducking the punches, walking right into them. Joel had a wedding and we all went. When his father told his daughter to take it easy, she clung to my neck and said she was fine. "I'm adopted, you know, which means he's not my real father." Her face clung to her hair this time. "I'm adopted, so you're not my real brother's friends." She wore the same perfume as the bride, and we breathed deep the whole night. Joel had a wedding and we all went. At the end, the limo got stuck in the roundabout, and Joel and his bride had to walk down the gravel drive. I would have carried her. I would have never put her down. And then the limo turned out of the drive, turned down the mountain, and we turned away to look for our cars, the cars we had lost, the cars we had lost. Thank you.
Okay, thank you again, Todd. That was awesome. Can we get another round of applause for both of them? Great. Okay. Remember to tip your bartender well for all he has done for you. And thank you guys for coming out. We will see you in 1 week. Okay, did you have any other announcements?
Sure. Yeah. This is really tall now. We will see you in 1 week for Jesse Lee Kercheval, I believe. And that was my announcement. Y'all have a great night. Thank you.